You've been so careful. Your love for her is only a burden she endures out of politeness. Remember that.
But Tessa was only pulling aside the curtain as the carriage came to a stop. They were rolling into a mews, from whose entry hung a sign. All drivers of vehicles are directed to walk their horses while passing under this archway.
We are here, she said, as if he had not said a word. Perhaps he had not, Will thought. Perhaps he had not spoken aloud. Perhaps he was only losing his mind. Certainly it was not unimaginable under the circumstances. When the carriage door opened, it brought with it a blast of cool Chelsea air. He saw Tessa raise her head as Cyril helped her down. He joined Tessa on the cobblestones. The place smelled of the Thames. Before the embankment had been built, the river had come much closer to these rows of houses, their edges softened by gaslight in the darkness. Now the river was separated by a greater distance, but one could still smell the salt, dirt, iron tang of water. The front of number 16 was Georgian, made of plain red brickwork, with a bay window that jutted out over the front door. There was a small paved court and a garden behind an elegant fence with a great deal of delicate, scrolling ironwork. The gate was already open. Tessa pushed through and marched up the front steps to knock upon the door, Will only a few steps behind her. The door was opened by Woolsey Scott, wearing a canary-yellow brocaded silk dressing gown over trousers and a shirt. He had a gold monocle perched in one eye socket, and regarded them both through it with some distaste.
"Bother," he said. "I would have had the footman answer and send you away, but I thought you were somebody else."
"Who?"
Tessa inquired, which did not seem to Will to be germane to the issue, but it was Tessa's way. She was forever asking questions. Leave her alone in a room, and she'd be asking questions of the furniture and plants.
"Someone with absinthe?"
"Swallow enough of that stuff, and you'll think you are someone else," said Will.
"We're seeking Magnus Bane. If he isn't here, just tell us, and we'll not take up any more of your time."
Woolsey sighed, as if greatly prevailed upon.
"Magnus," he called. "It's your blue-eyed boy."
There were footsteps in the corridor behind Woolsey, and Magnus appeared in full evening dress, as if he had just come from a ball. Starched white shirt front and cuffs, swallow-tail black coat, and a hair like a ragged fringe of dark silk. His eyes flicked from Will to Tessa.
"And to what do I owe the honor at such a late hour?"
"A fever," Will said, and amended himself when Magnus's eyebrows went up.
"A question."
Woolsey sighed and stepped back from the door.
"Very well.
Come into the drawing room."
No one offered to take their hats or coats, and once they reached the drawing room, Tessa stripped off her gloves and stood with her hands close to the fire, shivering slightly.
Her hair was a damp mess of curls at the back of her neck, and Will looked away from her before he could remember what it felt like to put his hands through that hair and feel the strands wind about his fingers. It was easier at the Institute, with Jem and the others to distract him, to remember that Tessa was not his to recall that way. Here, feeling as if he were facing the world with her by his side, feeling that she was here for him instead of, quite sensibly, for the health of her own fiancé, it was nearly impossible. Woolsey threw himself into a flower-patterned armchair. He had plucked the monocle from his eye and was swinging it around his fingers on its long gold chain.
"I simply cannot wait to hear what this is about."
Magnus moved toward the fireplace and leaned against the mantel, the very picture of a young gentleman at leisure. The room was painted a pale blue and decorated with paintings that featured vast fields of granite, gleaming blue seas, and men and women in classical dress. Will thought he recognized a reproduction of an Al-Matadama. Or at least, it must have been a reproduction, mustn't it?
"Don't gape at the walls, Will," said Magnus. "You've been all but absent for months. What brings you here now?"
"I do not want to trouble you," Will muttered. It was only partly the truth. Once the curse Will had believed he was under had been proved by Magnus to be false, he had avoided Magnus. Not because he was angry with the warlock, or had no more need of him, but because the sight of Magnus caused him pain. He had written him a short letter, telling him what had happened and that his secret was a secret no more. He had spoken of Jem's engagement to Tessa, and he had asked that Magnus not reply.
But this is a crisis. Magnus's cat eyes widened.
What sort of crisis?
It is about Yin Fen, said Will.
Gracious, Wolsey said.
Don't tell me Marpak is taking the stuff again.
No, Will said. There is none of it to take.
He saw a dawning comprehension on Magnus's face and went to explain the situation as best he could.
Magnus didn't change expression as Will spoke, any more than Church did when someone spoke to him. Magnus only watched out of his gold-green eyes until Will was done.
And without the Yin Fen, Magnus said at last.
He will die, said Tessa, turning from the fireplace. Her cheeks were flushed carnation pink, whether from the heat of the fire or the stress of the situation. Will could not tell.
Not immediately, but within the week. His body cannot sustain itself without the powder.
How does he take it? Wolsey inquired. Dissolved in water, or inhaled?
What's that got to do with anything? Will demanded.
Nothing, Wolsey said. I was only wondering.
Demon drugs are a curious thing.
For us, who love him, it is a sight more than curious, Tessa said.
Her chin was up, and Will remembered what he had said to her once about being like Boadicea. She was brave, and he adored her for it, even as it was employed in defense of her love for someone else.
Why have you come to me with this? Magnus's voice was quiet.
You helped us before, Tessa said. We thought perhaps you could help again. You helped with the Quincy, and Will, with his curse.
I am not at your beck and call, Magnus said. I helped with the Quincy because Camille requested it of me, and Will, once, because he offered me a favor in return. I am a warlock, and I do not serve shadow hunters for free.
And I am not a shadow hunter, said Tessa.
There was a silence, then, Magnus said, and turned away from the fire. I understand, Tessa, that you are to be congratulated.
I...
On your engagement to James Carstairs.
Oh.
She flushed, and her hand went to her throat, where she always wore Jem's mother's necklace, his gift to her.
Yes, thank you.
Will felt, rather than saw, Wolsey's eyes on all three of them, Magnus, Tessa, and himself, sliding from one to the other, the mind behind the eyes examining, deducing, enjoying. Will's shoulders tightened.
I would be happy to offer anything, he said, this time. Another favor or whatever you wanted for the Yin Fen. If it's payment, I could arrange. That is, I could try.
I may have helped you before, Magnus said. But this, he sighed. Think, the pair of you. If someone is buying up all the Yin Fen in the country, then it is someone who has a reason. And who has a reason to do that?
Mortmain,
Tessa whispered before Will could say it.
He could still remember his own voice.
Mortmain's minions have been buying up the Yin Fen supply in the East End. I confirmed it. If you would run out, and he was the only one with the supply,
we would have been put in his power, said Jem. Unless you were willing to let me die, of course, which would be the sensible course of action.
But with enough Yin Fen to last them 12 months, Will had thought there was no danger, had thought that Mortmain would find some other way to harry and torment them, for surely he would see this plan could not work. Will had not expected a year's worth of the drug to be gone in 8 weeks.
You do not want to help us, Will said. You do not want to position yourself as an enemy of Mortmain's.
Well, can you blame him? Wolsey rose in a whirl of yellow silk. What could you possibly have to offer that would make the risk worth it to him?
I will give you anything, said Tessa in a low voice that Will felt in his bones. Anything at all. If you can help us help Jem.
Magnus gripped a handful of his black hair.
God, the two of you.
I can make inquiries, track down some of the more unusual shipping routes. Old Molly...
I've been to her, Will said.
Something frightened her so badly she won't even crawl out of a grave.
Woolsey snorted. And that doesn't tell you anything, little shadow hunter. Is it really worth all this, just to stretch your friend's life out another few months, another year? He'll die anyway. And the sooner he dies, the sooner you can have his fiancée, the one you're in love with. He cut his amused gaze towards Tessa. Really, you ought to be counting with great eagerness the days till he expires.
Will did not know what happened after that. Everything went suddenly white, and Woolsey's monocle was flying across the room. Will's head hit something painfully, and the werewolf was under him, kicking and swearing, and they were rolling across the rug, and there was a sharp pain in his wrist where Woolsey had clawed him. The pain cleared his head, and he was aware that Woolsey was pinning him to the ground, his eyes gone yellow and his teeth bared as sharp as daggers, ready to bite.
"Stop it! Stop it!" Tessa, by the fire, had seized up a poker. Will choked and put his hand against Woolsey's face, pushing him away. Woolsey yelled, and suddenly the weight was off Will's chest. Magnus had lifted the werewolf and shoved him away. Then Magnus's hands were fisted in the back of Will's jacket, and Will found himself being dragged from the room, Woolsey staring after him, one hand to his face where Will's silver ring had burned his cheekbone.
"Let me go! Let me go!"
Will struggled, but Magnus's grip was like iron. He marched Will down the corridor into a half-lit library. Will pulled free just as Magnus let go of him, resulting in an inelegant stumble that fetched him up against the back of a red velvet sofa.
"I cannot leave Tessa alone with Woolsey."
"Her virtue is hardly in danger from him," Magnus said dryly. "Woolsey will behave himself, which is more than I can say for you."
Will turned around slowly, wiping blood from his face.
"You're glaring at me," he said to Magnus. "You look like Church before he bites someone."
"Picking a fight with the head of the Praetor Lupus," Magnus said bitterly. "You know what his pack would do to you if they had an excuse." "You want to die, don't you?"
"I don't," Will said, surprising even himself a little.
"I don't know why I ever helped you."
"You like broken things."
Magnus took two strides across the room and seized Will's face in his long fingers, forcing his chin up.
"You are not Sidney Carton," he said. "What good will it do you to die for James Carstairs, when he's dying anyway?"
"Because if I save him, then it is worth it."
"God!" Magnus's eyes narrowed. "What is worth it? What could possibly be worth it?"
"Everything I've lost," Will shouted. "Tessa!"
Magnus dropped his hands from Will's face. He took several paces backward and breathed in and out slowly, as if mentally counting to 10.
"I'm sorry," he said finally, "about what Woolsey said. If Jem dies, I cannot be with Tessa," said Will, "because it would be as if I were waiting for him to die, or took some joy in his death if it let me have her. And I will not be that person. I will not profit from his death. So he must live." He lowered his arm, his sleeve bloody. "It is the only way any of this can mean anything. Otherwise it is only pointless, needless suffering and pain.
I don't suppose it would help if I told you that is the way life is. The good suffer, the evil flourish, and all that is mortal passes away."
"I want more than that," said Will. "You made me want more than that. You showed me I was only ever cursed because I had chosen to believe myself so. You told me there was possibility, meaning. And now you would turn your back on what you created?"
Magnus laughed shortly. "You are incorrigible."
"I've heard that."
Will pulled himself away from the sofa, wincing.
"You'll help me then?"
"I'll help you."
Magnus reached down his shirt front and drew out something that dangled on a chain, something that glowed with a soft red light. A square red stone. "Take this." He folded it into Will's hand. Will looked at him in confusion.
"This was Camille's."
"I gave it to her as a gift," said Magnus, a bitter quirk to the side of his mouth. "She returned all my gifts to me last month. You might as well take it. It warns when demons are close.
It might work on those clockwork creations of Mortmain's.
True love cannot die,
Will said, translating the inscription on the back in the light from the corridor.
I can't wear this, Magnus. It's too pretty for a man.
So are you. Go home and clean yourself up. I will call upon you as soon as I have information. He looked at Will keenly. In the meantime, do your best to be worthy of my assistance.
If you come near me, I shall bash in your head with this poker, Tessa said, brandishing the fireplace instrument between herself and Wolsey Scott as if it were a sword.
I've no doubt you would too, he said, looking at her with a grudging sort of respect as he mopped the blood from his chin with a monogrammed handkerchief. Will had been bloody too, his own blood and Wolsey's. He was doubtless in another room with Magnus now, getting more blood smeared everywhere. Will was never over-concerned with neatness, and even less so when he was emotional.
I see you've begun to be like them, the shadow hunters you seem to adore so much. Whatever possess you to engage yourself to one of them, and a dying one at that.
Rage flared up in Tessa, and she considered smacking Wolsey with a poker whether he came near her or not. He had moved awfully quickly while fighting Will, though, and she didn't fancy her chances.
You don't know James Carstairs. Don't speak about him.
Love him, do you? Wolsey managed to make it sound unpleasant. But you love Will, too. Tessa froze and sighed. She had known that Magnus knew of Will's affection for her, but the idea that what she felt for him in return was written across her face was too terrifying to contemplate.
That's not true.
Liar, said Wolsey.
Really,
what is the difference if one of them dies? You always have a fine secondary option. Tessa thought of Jim, of the shape of his face, his eyes shut in concentration as he played the violin, the curve of his mouth when he smiled, his fingers careful in hers, every line of him inexpressibly dear to her.
If you had two children, she said, would you say it was all right if one of them died, because then you'd still have another?
One can love two children, but your heart can be given in romantic love to only a single other, said Wolsey. That is the nature of Eros, is it not? So novels would tell us, though I have no experience of it myself.
I have come to understand something about novels, Tessa said.
And what is that?
That they are not true.
Wolsey quirked an eyebrow. You're a funny thing, he said. I would say I could see what those boys see in you, but... He shrugged. His yellow dressing gown had a long, bloody tear in it now. Women are not something I've ever understood.
What about them do you find mysterious, sir?
The point of them, mainly.
Well, you must have had a mother, said Tessa.
Someone whelped me, yes, said Wolsey without much enthusiasm. I remember her little.
Perhaps, but you would not exist without a woman, would you? However little use you may find us, we are cleverer and more determined and more patient than men. Men may be stronger, but it is women who endure.
And is that what you're doing? Enduring?
Surely an engaged woman should be happier.
His light eyes raked her. A heart divided against itself cannot stand, as they say. You love them both, and it tears you apart.
House, said Tessa.
He raised an eyebrow.
What was that?
A house divided against itself cannot stand, not a heart. Perhaps you should not attempt quotations if you cannot get them correct.
And maybe you should stop pitying yourself, he said. Most people are lucky to even have one great love in their life. You have found two.
Says the man who has none.
Oh! Wolsey staggered back with his hand against his heart, mock swooning. The dove has teeth.
Very well. If you don't wish to discuss personal matters, then perhaps something more general. Your own nature. Magnus seems convinced you are a warlock.
But I'm not so sure.
I think there may be some of the blood of fairies about you. For what is the magic of shape-changing if it is not a magic of illusion? And who are the masters of magic and illusion if not the fair folk?
Tessa thought of the blue-haired fairy woman at Benedict's party who had claimed to know her mother, and her breath hitched in her throat. Before she could say another word to Woolsey, though, Magnus and Will came back in through the door. Will, as predicted, just as bloody as before and scowling. He looked from Tessa to Woolsey and laughed a short laugh.
"I suppose you were right, Magnus," he said. "Tessa is in no danger from him. One cannot say the same in reverse."
"Tessa, darling, put the poker down," Magnus said, holding out his hand. "Woolsey can be dreadful, but there are better ways of handling his moods."
With a last glare at Woolsey, Tessa handed the poker to Magnus. She went to retrieve her gloves and Will his coat, and there was a blur of movement and voices, and she heard Woolsey laugh. She was barely paying attention. She was too focused on Will. She could tell already from the look on his face that whatever he and Magnus had said to each other in private, it had not solved the problem of Jem's drugs. He looked haunted and a little deadly, the blood freckling his high cheekbones, only making the blue of his eyes more startling. Magnus led them from the drawing room and out to the front door, where the cool air hit Tessa like a wave. She tugged her gloves on and nodded a goodbye to Magnus, who shut the door, closing the two of them out in the night. The Thames glittered past the trees, the roadway, and the embankment, and the gas lamps on Battersea Bridge shone down into the water, a nocturne in blue and gold. The shadow of the carriage was visible beneath the trees by the gate. Above them, the moon appeared and disappeared between moving banks of grey cloud. Will was utterly still. "Tessa," he said. His voice sounded peculiar, odd and choked. Tessa stepped quickly down to stand beside him, looking up into his face. Will's face was so often changeable as moonlight itself, she had never seen his expression so still.
"Did he say he would help?" she whispered. "Magnus?" "He will try. But the way he looked at me, he felt sorry for me, Tess. That means there's no hope, doesn't it? If even Magnus thinks the endeavor is doomed, there is nothing more I can do, is there?"
She laid her hand upon his arm. He did not move. It was so peculiar, being this close to him, the familiar feel and presence of him. When for months they had avoided each other, had barely spoken, he had not even wanted to meet her eyes. And now he was here, smelling of soap and rain and blood and Will.
"You have done so much," she whispered. "Magnus will try and help, and we will keep searching, and something may yet come to light. You cannot abandon hope."
"I know. I know it. And yet I feel such a dread in my heart, as if it were the last hour of my life. I have felt hopelessness before, Tess, but never such fear. And yet I have known, I have always known, that Jem would die." She did not say it. It was between them, unspoken. "Who am I?" he whispered. "For years I pretended I was other than I was, and then I gloried that I might return to the truth of myself, only to find there is no truth to return to. I was an ordinary child, and then I was not a very good man. And now I do not know how to be either of those things any longer. I do not know what I am, and when Jem is gone, there'll be no one to show me."
"I know just who you are. You're Will Herondale," was all she said, and then suddenly his arms were around her, his head on her shoulder. She froze at first out of pure astonishment, and then carefully she returned the embrace, holding him as he shuddered. He was not crying. This was something else, a sort of paroxysm, as if he were choking. She knew she should not touch him, yet she could not imagine Jem wanting her to push Will away at such a moment. She could not be Jem for him, she thought, could not be his compass that always pointed north. But if nothing else, she could make his a slighter burden to carry.
"Would you like this rather dreadful snuff box someone gave me? It's silver, so I can't touch it," Woolsey said.
Magnus, standing at the bay window of the drawing room, the curtain pulled aside just enough so he could see Will and Tessa on his front steps, clinging to each other as if their lives depended on it, hummed, noncommittally in response. Woolsey rolled his eyes.
"Still out there, are they?"
"Quite."
"Messy,"
all that romantic love business, said Wolsey. Much better to go on as we do, only the physical matters.
Indeed.
Will and Tessa had broken apart at last, though their hands were still joined. Tessa appeared to be coaxing Will down the steps. Do you think you would have married if you hadn't had nephews to carry on the family name?
Oh, I suppose I would have had to. Cry God for England, Harry, St. George, and the Praetor Lupus.
Wolsey laughed. He had poured himself a glass of red wine from the decanter on the sideboard, and he swirled it now, gazing down into its changeable depths.
You gave Will Camille's necklace, he observed.
How did you know? Mangs's mind was only half on the conversation. The other half was watching Will and Tessa walk toward their carriage. Somehow, despite the difference in their height and build, she appeared to be the one who was being leaned upon.
You were wearing it when you left the room with him, but not when you returned. I don't suppose you told him what it's worth, that he's wearing a ruby that would cost more than the Institute.
I didn't want it, Magnus said.
Tragic reminder of lost love?
Didn't suit my complexion. Will and Tessa were in the carriage now, and the driver was snapping the reins. Do you think there's a chance for him?
A chance for who?
Will Herondale? To be happy? Wolsey sighed gustily and put down his glass.
Is there a chance for you to be happy if he isn't?
Magnus said nothing.
Are you in love with him? Wolsey asked,
all curiosity, no jealousy. Magnus wondered what it was like to have a heart like that, or rather to have no heart at all.
No, Magnus said.
I have wondered that, but no. It is something else. I feel that I owe him. I have heard it said that when you save a life, you are responsible for that life. I feel I am responsible for that boy. If he never finds happiness, I will feel I have failed him. If he cannot have that girl he loves, I will feel I have failed him. If I cannot keep his Parabatai by him, I will feel I have failed him.
Then you will fail him, Wolsey said. In the meantime, while you're moping and seeking Yin Feng, I think I might take myself travelling, see the countryside. The city depresses me in the winter.
Do as you like, Magnus let the curtain fall back, blocking the view of Will and Tessa's carriage as it passed out of sight.
To Consul Josiah Whalen, from Inquisitor Victor Whitelaw. Josiah, I was deeply concerned to hear of your letter to the Council on the topic of Chart Branwell. As old acquaintances, I had hoped you could perhaps speak more freely to me than you have to them. Is there some issue regarding her that concerns you? Her father was a dear friend of ours both, and I have not known her to do a dishonourable thing. Yours in concern, Victor Whitelaw.
Chapter 6. Let Darkness. Let love clasp grief, lest both be drowned. Let darkness keep her raven gloss. Ah, sweeter to be drunk with loss, to dance with death, to beat the ground. Alfred Lord Tennyson, In Memoriam, A.H.H.
To Inquisitor Victor Whitelaw, from Consul Josiah Wayland.
This letter never sent.
It is with some trepidation that I pen this letter to you, Victor, for all that we have known each other for some years now. I feel a bit like the prophetess Cassandra, doomed to know the truth, and yet to have no one believe her. Perhaps it is my sin of hubris which puts Charlotte Branwell in the place she now occupies, and from which she devils me. Her undermining of my authority is constant, the instability which I fear it will cause in the clave severe. What should have been a disaster for her, the revelation that she harboured spies under her roof, the Lovelace girl's complicity in the Magister's schemes, has been recast as a triumph. The enclave hails the inhabitants of the Institute as those who uncovered the Magister and have harried him from London. That he has not been seen or heard from in the past months has been put down to Charlotte's good judgment, and it is not seen, as I suspect it is, as a tactical retreat and regrouping on his part. though I am the consul and lead the clave. It seems very much to me that this will go down as the time of Charlotte Branwell, and that my legacy will be lost. To Inquisitor Victor Whitelaw, from Consul Josiah Wayland.
This letter was sent.
Victor, while your concern is much appreciated, I have no anxiety regarding Charlotte Branwell that I did not touch on in my letter to the Council. May you take heart in the strength of the angel in these troubled times. Josiah Wayland.
Breakfast was at first a quiet affair. Gideon and Gabriel came down together, both subdued, Gabriel barely saying a word, aside from asking Henry to pass the butter. Cecily had placed herself at the far end of the table and was reading a book as she ate. Tessa longed to see the title, but Cecily had placed the book at such an angle that it was not visible. Will, across from Tessa, had the dark shadows of sleepiness below his eyes, a memory of their eventful night. Tessa herself poked unenthusiastically at her kedgeree, silent until the door opened and Jem came in. She looked up with surprise and a lurch of delight. He did not look unusually ill, only tired and pale. He slid gracefully into the seat beside her.
Good morning.
You look much better, Jemmy, Charlotte observed with delight.
Jemmy?
Tessa looked at Jem with amusement. He shrugged and gave her a self-deprecating grin. She looked across the table and found Will watching them. Her gaze brushed his just for a moment, a question in her eyes. Was there any chance that somehow Will had found some replacement Yin Fen in the time between returning home and this morning? But no, he looked as surprised as she felt.
I am quite, Jem said. The Silent Brothers were of great assistance.
He reached to pour himself a cup of tea, and Tessa watched the bones and tendons move in his thin wrist, distressingly visible. When he set the pot down, she reached for his hand beneath the table and he clasped it, his slim fingers wound about hers reassuringly. Bridget's voice floated out from the kitchen.
Cold blows the wind tonight, sweetheart. Cold are the drops of rain. The very first love that ever I had, in Greenwood he was slain. I'll do as much for my sweetheart as any young woman may. I'll sit and mourn at his graveside a 12 months and a day.
By the angel, she's depressing, said Henry,
setting down his newspaper directly on his plate and causing the edge to soak through with egg yolk. Charlotte opened her mouth as if to object and closed it again.
It's all the heartbreak, death, and unrequited love.
Well, that is what most songs are about, said Will. Requited love is ideal, but it doesn't make much of a ballad.
Jem looked up, but before he could say anything, a great reverberation sounded through the institute. Tessa was familiar enough with her London home now to know it was the sound of the doorbell. They all looked down the table at the same time at Charlotte, as if their heads were mounted on springs. Charlotte, looking startled, put down her fork.
Oh dear, she said. There is something I had meant to tell you all, but...
Ma'am? It was Sophie, drifting into the room with a salver in one hand. Tessa could not help but notice that though Gideon was staring at her, she seemed to be deliberately avoiding his gaze, her cheeks pinking slightly.
Consul Wayland is downstairs, requesting to speak with you.
Charlotte took the folded paper off the salver, gazed at it, sighed, and said,
Very well.
Send him up. Sophie vanished in a swirl of skirts.
Charlotte?
Henry sounded puzzled.
What is going on?
Indeed.
Will let his cutlery clatter onto his plate.
The consul. Breaking up our breakfast time. Whatever next? The Inquisitor over for tea? Picnics with the Silent Brothers?
Duck pies in the park, Jem said under his breath. And he and Will smiled at each other, just a flash, before the door opened and the consul swept in. Consul Whalen was a big man, broad-chested and thick-armed, and the robes of the consul's status always seemed to hang a bit awkwardly from his wide shoulders. He was blonde-bearded like a Viking, and at the moment his expression was stormy.
Charlotte, he said without preamble, I am here to talk to you about Benedict Lightwood.
There was a faint rustling. Gabriel's fingers had clenched on the tablecloth. Gideon put a hand lightly over his brother's wrist, stilling him. But the consul was already looking at them.
Gabriel, he said, I had rather thought you might go to the Blackthorns with your sister.
Gabriel's fingers tightened on the handle of his teacup. They are quite overset in their grief for Rupert, he said. I did not think now was the time to intrude.
Well, you are grieving for your father, are you not? Said the consul. Grief shared is grief lessened, they say.
Consul, Gideon began, shooting a worried look at his brother.
Though perhaps it might be rather awkward to lodge with your sister, considering that she has brought a complaint against you for murder.
Gabriel made a noise, as if someone had spilled boiling water over him. Gideon threw his napkin down and stood up.
Tatiana did what? He demanded.
You heard me, the consul said.
It was not murder, said Jem.
As you say, said the consul. I was informed that it was.
Were you also informed that Benedict had turned into a gigantic worm? Will inquired, and Gabriel looked at him in surprise, as if he had not expected to be defended by Will. Will, please, Charlotte said. Consul, I notified you yesterday that Benedict Lightwood had been discovered to be in the last stages of Astriola.
You told me that there was a battle and he was killed, the consul replied. But what I am hearing reported is that he was ill with the pox, and that as a result he was hunted down and killed, despite offering no resistance.
Will, his eyes suspiciously bright, opened his mouth. Jem reached out and clapped a hand over it.
I cannot understand, Jem said, talking over Will's muffled protest. How could you know that Benedict Lightwood is dead, but not the manner of his death? If there was no body to find, it was because he had become more demon than human and had vanished when slain as demons do. But the missing servants, the death of Tatiana's own husband...
The consul looked weary.
Tatiana Blackthorn says that a group of shadow hunters from the Institute murdered her father and that Rupert was killed in the brawl.
Did she mention that her father had eaten her husband? Henry inquired, finally looking up from his newspaper.
Oh yes, ate him. Left his bloody boot in the garden for us to find. And there were teeth marks. Love to know how that could have been an accident.
I would think that counted as offering resistance, Will said. Eating one's son-in-law, that is. Though I suppose everyone has their family altercations.
You are not seriously suggesting, Charlotte said, that the worm, that Benedict, should have been subdued and restrained, are you, Josiah? He was in the last stages of the pox. He had gone mad and become a worm.
He could have become a worm and then gone mad, Will said diplomatically. We cannot be entirely sure.
Tatiana is greatly upset, the consul said. She is considering demanding reparations.
Then I will pay them. It was Gabriel, having pushed his chair back from the table and risen to his feet. I will give my ridiculous sister my salary for the rest of my life if she desires it, but I will not admit to wrongdoing. Not for myself, not for any of us. Yes, I put an arrow through his eye. Its eye. And I will do it again. Whatever that thing was, it was not my father anymore. There was a silence. Even the consul did not seem to have a ready word to hand. Cecily put her book down and was looking intently from Gabriel to the consul and back again.
I beg your pardon, consul, but whatever Tatiana is telling you, she does not know the truth of the situation, said Gabriel. Only I was there in the house with my father as he sickened. I was alone with him as he was going mad for the past fortnight. Finally, I came here. I begged for my brother's help, Gabriel said. Charlotte kindly lent me the assistance of her shadow hunters, and by the time we had arrived back at the house, the thing that had been my father had torn my sister's husband apart. I assure you, Consul, there was no manner in which my father could have been saved. We were in a fight for our lives.
Then why would Tatiana?
Because she is humiliated, Tessa said. It was the first word she had spoken since the consul had entered the room. She said as much to me. She believed it would be a blight on the family name if the demon pox was known of. I assume she's trying to present some kind of alternative narrative in hopes that you will repeat it to the council. that she is not telling the truth.
Really, Consul, said Gideon, what makes more sense? That we all ran mad and killed my father and his sons are covering it up, or that Tatiana is lying? She never thinks things through, you know that.
Gabriel stood with his hand on the back of his brother's chair. If you believe that I would have so lightly committed patricide, feel free to bring me to the Silent City to be questioned.
That would probably be the most sensible course of action, the consul said.
Cecily set her teacup down with a sharp bang that made everyone at the table jump.
That is not fair, she said. He is telling the truth. We all are. You must know that.
The consul gave her a long, measuring look, then turned back to Charlotte.
You expect my trust, he said, and yet you conceal your actions from me. Actions have consequences, Charlotte.
Josiah, I informed you about what happened at Lightwood House the moment everyone returned, and I was assured they were all right.
You should have told me before, the consul said flatly. The moment Gabriel arrived. This was no routine mission. As it is, you have left yourself in a position in which I must defend you, despite the fact that you disobeyed protocol and set upon this mission without council approval.
There wasn't time.
Enough,
said the consul, in a voice that implied it was anything but enough.
Gideon and Gabriel, you will come with me to the Silent City to be questioned.
Charlotte began to protest, but the consul held up a hand.
To have Gabriel and Gideon cleared by the brothers is expedient. It will avoid any mess and allow me to have Tatiana's request for reparations dismissed swiftly. Two of you, Consul Whalen turned to the Lightwood brothers, go downstairs to my carriage and wait for me. We will all three adjourn to the Silent City, and when the brothers are done with you, if they find nothing of interest, we will return you here.
If they find nothing, Gideon said in a disgusted tone. He took his brother by the shoulders and guided him out of the room. As Gideon closed the door behind them, Tessa noticed something spark on his hand. He was wearing his Lightwood ring again.
All right, said the consul, rounding on Charlotte. Why did you not tell me the very moment your shadow hunters returned and told you Benedict was dead?
Charlotte fixed her eyes on her tea. Her mouth was pressed into a firm line. I wanted to protect the boys, she said. I wanted them to have some moments of peace and quiet. Some respite after seeing their father die before their eyes, before you started asking questions, Josiah.
That is hardly all, the consul went on, ignoring her expression. Benedict's books and papers. Tatiana told us of them. We searched his house, but his journals are gone. His desk is empty. This is not your investigation, Charlotte. Those papers belong to the Clave.
What are you searching for in them?
Henry asked, moving his newspaper off his plate. He sounded deceptively uninterested in the answer, but there was a hard glint in his eyes that belied his apparent disinterest.
Information about his connection to Mortmain. Information about any other Clave members that might have had connection to Mortmain. Clues as to Mortmain's whereabouts.
And his devices? Henry said.
The consul paused mid-sentence.
His devices?
The infernal devices. His army of automatons. It is an army created for the purpose of destroying Shadowhunters, and he means to bend it against us.
Charlotte, seemingly recovered, said as she set her napkin down. And in fact, if Benedict's increasingly incomprehensible notes are believed, that time will come sooner rather than later.
So you did take his notes and journals. The Inquisitor was convinced of it.
The consul rubbed the back of his hand across his eyes.
Of course I took them. And of course I will give them to you. I always plan to do so.
Eminently composed, Charlotte picked up a small silver bell by her plate and rang it. And when Sophie appeared, she whispered to the girl for a moment, and Sophie, with a curtsy to the consul, slipped out of the room.
You should have left the papers where they were, Charlotte. It is procedure,
said the consul.
There was no reason for me not to look at them.
You must trust my judgment and the laws. Protecting the Lightwood boys is not a higher priority than discovering Mortmain's whereabouts, Charlotte. You are not running the Clave. You are part of the Enclave, and you will report to me, is that clear?
Yes, Consul, Charlotte said as Sophie re-entered the room with a packet of papers which she silently offered to the Consul. The next time one of our esteemed members turns into a worm and eats another esteemed member, we will inform you immediately. The Consul's jaws set.
Your father was my friend, he said. I trusted him, and because of that I have trusted you. Do not make me sorry that I appointed you, or supported you against Benedict Lightwood when he challenged your position.
You went along with Benedict, Charlotte cried. When he suggested I be given a fortnight only to complete an impossible task, you agreed to it. You spoke not a word in my defense. If I were not a woman, you would not have behaved in such a way.
If you were not a woman, the Consul said, I would not have had to.
And with that he was gone, in a swirl of dark robes and dully sparking runes. No sooner had the door closed behind him than Will hissed.
How could you give him those papers? We need those.
Charlotte, who was sagged back in her chair, her eyes half closed, said, Will, I have already been up all night copying down the relevant parts. Much of it was...
Gibberish?
Jem suggested.
Pornographic? Said Will at the same time.
Could be both, said Will. Haven't you heard of pornographic gibberish before? Jem grinned, and Charlotte put her face in her hands.
It was more the former than the latter, if you must know, she said. I copied down all that I could with Sophie's invaluable assistance. She looked up then.
Will, you need to remember. This is no longer our charge. Mortmain is the Clave's problem, or at least, that is how they see it. There was a time when we were singularly responsible for Mortmain, but...
We are responsible for protecting Tessa, Will said, with a sharpness that startled even Tessa.
Will paled slightly when he realized everyone had looked at him with surprise, but he went on anyway.
Mortmain wants Tessa still. We cannot imagine he has given up. He may come with automatons, he may come with witchcraft and fire and betrayal, but he will come.
Of course we will protect her, Charlotte said. We need no reminders, Will. She is one of our own. And speaking of our own, she glanced down at her plate, Jessamine returns to us tomorrow.
What?
Will upset his teacup, soaking the tablecloth with the dregs. There was a buzz around the table, though Cecily only stared in puzzlement, and Tessa, after a sharp intake of breath, stayed silent. She was remembering the last time she had seen Jessamine in the Silent City, pale and red-eyed, weeping and terrified.
He tried to betray us, Charlotte, and you're simply allowing her back.
She has no other family. Her wealth has been confiscated by the Clave, and she is besides in no fit state to live on her own. 2 months of questioning in the Bone City has left her nearly mad. I do not think she will be a danger to any of us.
Neither do we think she would be a danger before, said Jem in a harder voice than Tessa would have expected from him. And yet the course of action she took nearly placed Tessa in Mortmain's hands and the rest of us in disgrace.
Charlotte shook her head. There is a need here for mercy and pity. Jessamine is not what she once was, as any of you would know if you had visited her in the Silent City.
I have no wish to visit with traitors, said Will coldly. Was she still gibbering about Mortmain being an Idris?
Yes, that is why the Silent Brothers finally gave up. They could get no sense out of her. She has no secrets, nothing of worth that she knows. And she understands that. She feels worthless. If you could but put yourself in her shoes.
Oh, I don't doubt she's putting on a show for you, Charlotte, weeping and rending her garments.
Well, if she's rending her garments, said Jem, with a flick of a smile towards his parabatai, you know how much Jessamine likes her garments. Will's smile back was grudging but real. Charlotte saw her opening and pressed the advantage.
You will not even know her when you see her, I promise you that, she said. Give it a week only. And if none of you can bear to have her here, I will arrange for her transport to Idris. She pushed her plate away. And now to go through my copies of Benedict's papers. Who will assist me?
To Consul Josiah Wayland, from the Council. Dear Sir,
Until our receipt of your last letter, we had thought our difference in thought on the topic of Charlotte Branwell to be a matter of simple opinion. Though you may not have given express permission for the removal of Jessamine Lovelace to the Institute, the approval was granted by the Brotherhood, who are in charge of such things. It seemed to us the action of a generous heart to allow the girl back into the only home she has known, despite her wrongdoings. As for Wolsey Scott, he leads the Praetor Lupus, an organization we have long considered allies. Your suggestion that Mrs. Branwell may have given her ear to those who do not have the Clave's best interests at heart is deeply troubling. Without proof, however, we are reluctant to move forward with this as a basis of information. In Raziel's name, the members of the Nephilim Council. The Consul's carriage was a shining red five-glass landau, with the four C's of the Clave on the side, drawn by a pair of impeccable grey stallions. It was a wet day, drizzling faintly. His driver sat slumped in the seat up front, almost entirely hidden by an oilskin hat and cloak. With a frown, the Consul, who had not said a word since they had left the breakfast room of the Institute, ushered Gideon and Gabriel into the carriage, climbed up after, and latched the door behind them. As the carriage lurched away from the church, Gabriel turned to stare out the window. There was a faint burning pressure behind his eyes and in his stomach. It had come and gone since the previous day, sometimes rolling over him so strongly that he thought he might be sick.
A gigantic worm. The last stages of Astriola. The demon pox.
When Charlotte and the rest of them had first made their accusations against his father, he hadn't wanted to believe it. Gideon's defection had seemed like madness, a betrayal so monstrous that it could be explained only by insanity. His father had promised that Gideon would rethink his actions, that he would return to help with the running of the house and the business of being a Lightwood. But he had not come back, and as the days had grown shorter and darker, and Gabriel had seen less and less of his father, he had first begun to wonder and then to be afraid.
Benedict was hunted down and killed. Hunted and killed.
Gabriel rolled the words around in his mind, but they made no sense. He had killed a monster, as he had grown up being trained to do, but that monster had not been his father. His father was still alive somewhere, and any moment Gabriel would look out the window of the house and see him striding up the walk, his long grey coat flapping in the wind, the clean sharp lines of his profile outlined against the sky. Gabriel. It was his brother's voice, cutting through the fog of memory and daydream. Gabriel, the Consul asked you a question. Gabriel looked up. The Consul was regarding him, his dark eyes expectant. The carriage was rolling through Fleet Street, journalists and barristers and costermongers all hurrying to and fro in the traffic.
I asked you, the Consul said, how you were enjoying the hospitality of the Institute.
Gabriel blinked at him. Little stood out for him among the fog of the past few days. Charlotte putting her arms around him, Gideon washing the blood off his hands, Cecily's face like a bright, angry flower.
It's all right, I suppose, he said in a rusty voice. It is not my home.
Well, Lightwood House is magnificent, said the Consul. Built on blood and spoils, of course.
Gabriel stared at him, uncomprehending. Gideon was looking out the window, his expression faintly sick.
I thought you wished to speak to us about Tatiana, he said.
I know Tatiana, said the Consul. None of your father's sense, and none of your mother's kindness. Rather a bad bargain for her, I'm afraid. Her request for reparations will be dismissed, of course.
Gideon twisted about in his seat and looked at the Consul incredulously.
If you credit her account so little, why are we here?
So if I could speak with you alone, the Consul said, you understand. When I first handed over the Institute to Charlotte, I had some thought that a woman's touch would be good for the place. Granville Fairchild was one of the strictest men I've known, and though he ran the Institute according to the law, it was a cold, unwelcoming place. Here in London, the greatest city in the world, and a shadow hunter could not feel at home.
He shrugged fluidly.
I thought giving over administration of the place to Charlotte might help.
Charlotte and Henry, Gideon corrected.
Henry was a cipher, said the consul. We all know, as the saying goes, that the grey mare is the better horse in that marriage. Henry was never meant to interfere, and indeed he does not. But neither was Charlotte. She was meant to be docile and obey my wishes. In that she has disappointed me deeply.
You backed her against our father, Gabriel blurted, and was immediately sorry he had. Gideon shot him a quelling glare, and Gabriel folded his gloved hands tightly in his lap, pressing his lips together. The consul's eyebrows went up.
Because your father would have been docile, he said. There were two bad ends, and I chose the best of them. I still had hopes of controlling her, but now...
Sir, Gideon cut in his best polite voice, why are you telling us this?
Ah,
said the consul, glancing out the Rain Street window.
Here we are.
He rapped on the carriage window.
Richard! Stop the carriage at the Argent Rooms.
Gabriel flicked his eyes towards his brother, who shrugged in bafflement. The Argent Rooms were a notorious music hall and gentlemen's club in Piccadilly Circus. Ladies of ill repute frequented the place, and there were rumours that the business was owned by downworlders, and that on some evenings the magic shows featured real magic.
I was to come here with your father, said the consul,
once all three of them were on the pavement. Gideon and Gabriel were staring up through the drizzle at the rather tasteless Italianate theatre front that had clearly been grafted onto the more modest building that had stood there before. It featured a triple loggia and some rather loud blue paint.
Once, the police revoked the Alhambra's license because the management had allowed the can-can to be danced upon their premises. But then the Alhambra is run by mundanes. This is much more satisfactory. Shall we go in?
His tone left no room for disagreement. Gabriel followed the consul through the arcaded entrance, where money changed hands and a ticket was purchased for each of them. Gabriel looked at his ticket with some puzzlement. It was in the form of an advertisement, promising the best entertainment in London. Feats of strength, he read off to Gideon as they made their way down a long corridor. Trained animals, strong women, acrobats, circus acts, and comic singers. Gideon was muttering under his breath. And contortionists, Gabriel added brightly. It looks like there's a woman here who can put her foot on top of her.
By the angel, this place is barely better than a penny gaff, Gideon said.
Gabriel, don't look at anything unless I tell you it's all right. Gabriel rolled his eyes as his brother took firm hold of his elbow and propelled him into what was clearly the Grand Salon, a massive room whose ceiling was painted with reproductions of Italian great masters, including Botticelli's Birth of Venus, now rather smoke-stained and the worse for wear. Gasoliers hung from gilded mounds of plaster, filling the room with a yellowish light. The walls were lined with velvet benches on which dark figures huddled, gentlemen, surrounded by ladies whose dresses were too bright and whose laughter was too loud. Music poured from the stage at the front room. The consul moved toward it, grinning. A woman in a top hat and tails was slinking up and down the stage, singing a song entitled, It's Naughty But It's Nice. As she turned, her eyes flashed out green beneath the light of the gasolier.
Werewolf, Gabriel thought.
We're here for a moment, boys, said the consul,
and he disappeared into the crowd. Lovely, Gideon muttered, and pulled Gabriel closer toward him as a woman in a tight bodiced satin dress swayed by them. She smelled of gin and something else beneath it, something dark and sweet, a bit like James Carstairs' scent of burned sugar. Who knew the consul was such a ramper, Gabriel said. Couldn't this have waited until after he took us to the Silent City? He's not taking us to the Silent City. Gideon's mouth was tight. He's not. Don't be a half-wit, Gabriel. Of course not. He wants something else from us. I don't know what yet. He took us here to unsettle us, and he wouldn't have done it if he weren't fairly sure that he has something over us that would prevent us from telling Charlotte or anyone else where we've been. Maybe he did used to come here with Father. Maybe. But that's not why we're here now, Gideon said with finality. He tightened his grip on his brother's arm as the consul reappeared, carrying with him a small bottle of what looked like soda water, but what Gabriel guessed likely had at least a tuppence worth of spirit in it. "What, nothing for us?" Gabriel inquired, and was met with a glance.